Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're here for two rules hearings and then an open administrative conference. Excuse me, and before we begin, I would like to say a special welcome to the Shanghai judges who are in Wisconsin for the third year to learn about practices in the Wisconsin court and to teach us about the ways that we might improve and do some comparative law with our judges. And they had 1 week in China with one of our Dane County judges earlier this year. So if you would stand so the court may see you, please. Welcome. You might be seated. You may be seated, please. We'll begin with the hearing on 04-11, In Re Proposed Amendment to Wisconsin Stat Rule 809-19, relating to the certification of compliance with WIS Stat Rule 809-19. We have as our presenter Margaret Carlson, Chief Staff Attorney for the Court of Appeals. I have no other appearances noted. Is there anyone else appearing on that petition? Ms. Carlson?
Morning, Judge, Justices. I am Pat Carlson. I am the Chief Staff Attorney for the Court of Appeals, and I'm requesting this, appearing this morning at the request of Chief Judge Kane and the Court of Appeals, who is the petitioner in this matter. As I'm certain you know, Rule 809-19 is the general rule of appellate procedure governing the content and form of briefs in the appellate courts. Sub 2 of that rule speaks to appendices and tells the filer what should be included in an appendix to the brief and whether any material reproduced in that appendix needs to be redacted for confidentiality purposes. The petition 411 that the court is proposing would create subsection 2A to that rule. It would require the filer of a brief to certify that the appendix that is being submitted to the court actually meets the content requirements in subsection 2. The certification language, as perhaps you noticed, is patterned on another certification that already exists in Rule 809-19, addressing form and length of briefs.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
If I were the Court of Appeals, I would want in the appendix the written order or judgment appealed from, because that's an issue that the court, I'm told, looks at initially to determine whether there's jurisdiction, right?
Among other things.
Yeah, okay. So where does that come in?
I believe that is included. I didn't.
Is that 3 or is it 4?
No, I believe in sub 2. I didn't go through it in the interest of time, but sub 2 does list, enumerate what should be included in the appendix, and one of the matters in there is the finding or opinion of the trial court, which typically is what.
And what about the notice of appeal? Because sometimes I have found that the notice of appeal does not make reference to the same document that I would view. Yeah, so it would seem to me that you would want the notice of appeal in there, too.
The notice of appeal is not included. I did notice in preparing for the hearing that is specifically mentioned, for instance, in the Seventh Circuit's laundry list of what should be included in appendix. I can't speak to why it never has gotten in the list of sub 2. I can say that to the extent that you're talking about the court's jurisdiction, That determination is, or that initial determination is made earlier in the process when the record comes through the court and the briefs are not relied on. It's a matter of looking at the record, finding the appealable document. And you are right. I would say, in my experience, at least half of the time, the designation of the document appealed from does not correlate with, but there's case law that says that's not jurisdictional.
It may not be jurisdictional, but it sure is interesting sometimes, and there may be more than one order or judgment which raises a problem. The other thing that is, the reason it's drafted this way, I think, I didn't draft it, is that it just follows precisely 809.19.2.
Oh, certainly. I was speaking to 809.19.2 when I was talking about that.
Yeah, but the certification just follows that. And why don't you just say that the statement complies with 809.19.2? It's, instead of a laundry list, why don't you say something like the following. The appendix to each appellant's brief should contain a statement certifying that the appendix complies with WIS Stat 809.19.2.
Well, I don't think the court would have an objection. I think part of the reasoning behind this entire rule petition is the more you have a practitioner,
you want
to read a document and read the contents, the more likely it is that compliance will actually occur. And if you shorthand it on the certification, perhaps they will never really go to the rule. And
okay, I have another question. What about when you're reviewing an administrative agency's ruling? Ordinarily, when the Court of Appeals does that, the trial court is not very significant in this because it's really not a review of the trial court but of the administrative agency. So you'd have to find that under 4, sub 4, portions of the record essential to an understanding of the issues raised, including all written rulings showing the trial court's. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I totally understand. And sub 2, the contents of the appendix, admittedly does not account for the various standards of review sort of scenarios where perhaps the court is going back beyond the circuit court level.
Yeah, because it's not really a circuit court.
That would be another petition, you know, to specifically address subsection 2. I don't imagine the court would be averse to that. I've not heard anecdotally of any specific complaints in the area of administrative review, and I suspect that the appendix is any less useful than other appendices, and I suspect that that's because of the nature of the litigants, where there tend to be more institutional litigants, where the DOJ, for instance, is representing the agency and knows what the court requires or would find useful.
These questions do not indicate that I don't approve of it, because it seems to me it's, non-controversial. If you really want certificates in the brief to call attention to the various rules. So my question really is perhaps broader of whether it will accomplish the goal, which is to have the appendix carry items that will really help a judge who is reading this brief and appendix without the benefit of the trial court record or administrative agency before them.
That does capture why the rule was first proposed at a meeting of the judges and the purpose of it. As you recognize, judges are often reading the briefs in a location that's different from where the physical record is located.
Even if they are three judges and staff attorneys and law clerks, so the record may not be readily available anyway.
Yeah, I believe that Attorney Heffernan, in his letter on behalf of the appellate section, he aptly captured the purpose of the rule, recognized that it really is not creating a substantive change, not an onerous burden, but simply trying to focus a practitioner's attention on a rule that, if it really were complied with on a more frequent basis, the court's efficiency would be enhanced greatly.
I ask a question. On 809.19.2, there is this statement If the record is required by law to be confidential, the portions of the record included in the appendix shall be reproduced using first names and last initials instead of full names of persons, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Are those requirements of confidentiality in one place for attorneys, or are they scattered around? Is there some way...
I wish that they were. I do not believe that they are. I know that every time I get that question, I have various post-it notes on certain sections. There's a section in 48 that speaks to a 938, 767 paternity. There are various sections. To my knowledge, there is not a single laundry list. One of the things I came, as I'm certain also the court knows, the Judicial Council has a standing subcommittee on appellate procedure, and perhaps that's something I'll volunteer for more work. I'm not sure exactly how to do that.
Let me
the cross-referencing.
Before that's done, the court improvement program, which Michelle Jensen directs, one of its activities several years ago was to try and compile the various confidentiality records, various confidentiality statutes in the statute book relating to children, part of the CIP. And they found, one reason they wanted to compile it was hard to find them. Two, they were not necessarily consistent. And counsel and others were disturbed by that. And so funds were expended, and the assistance of the Department of Justice was obtained to compile a compendium of these laws and then see what should be done about them. And it became a mammoth task, and I think it's in the compendium stage. I haven't checked on it recently, but I think that because of the difficulty.
If someone else is doing it, that's fine.
Well, I'm telling you that somebody attempted to do it, and success has not yet been declared.
Sometimes it's easier said than done. That's something I've experienced in that subcommittee.
Okay, so before one has the Judicial Council look at it, they should call and communicate with Ms. Jensen, and I will do that to find out what the status is. But the status at that time was... it was beyond, at that moment, beyond compilation and beyond making them fit together.
The short answer is no, there isn't a single list, but I believe that the clerk's office has a fairly comprehensive list of the statutes that are most often the subject of appeals, and their office checks for confidentiality in appendices, and if an appendix is not redacted appropriately, the brief is not accepted for filing. And
well, for example, I think within the last month, I have seen transcripts of, or maybe even decisions by trial courts, but certainly transcripts of discussions by circuit courts of names, proper names, where those names do not appear in the caption, and they're in the appendix. So it would seem to me vital that if you have a rule and you have a sanction for violating that rule, then the people who are supposed to prepare the appendices ought to know what the rules are.
Can't disagree with that. I'm certain, I don't doubt that things get passed and that there's material independencies that should not be there. I think the best efforts of the court personnel are made at the time of the brief being filed. I know that in the body of the brief especially, they look to the content. The appendices are often quite voluminous, and perhaps I misspoke. Maybe appendices are not checked. I certainly...
No, they are, but you might find 50 times it's
right.
Changed and one time it's not, or two times it's not, so they do slip by, but that's...
I'm certain one of the things that the rules also require is that a notice of appeal in a confidential case be redacted, and I'm certain that doesn't happen nearly as often as it should.
Could I ask a very basic question, and I'm embarrassed that I don't know the answer to this question. The attorney who is preparing, appellant's attorney,
mm-hmm.
does that attorney normally have all the required records that have been sent to him or her, or does the attorney have to go to the courthouse and go through the file?
Well, in answering that question, I have to include the caveat that it's been a long time since I've been in that position, since I've been with the court for so long, but I would, and then my flip answer is I certainly hope so. My real answer is I would imagine so. I mean, if you're, say, for instance, a criminal appellant defendant appointed by the public defender, you have the transcripts. You can get a copy of the court record that was clarified in some of the more recent revisions to the rules. Your pleadings, you should have the trial court decision. I guess it depends on how good of a filer you are.
We have had lawyers come up and say, I wasn't the trial lawyer, and I don't have a copy of the transcript. I didn't look at the record. And there are others who have, at the counsel table, copies of transcripts, copies of all the documents. So my own sense is it will depend on the quality of the lawyer.
And they certainly, if in the course of preparing... They're given every opportunity to accumulate. Before the record is filed, the clerk of the circuit court is supposed to give them notice of the contents.
They can go copy it.
Make a copy there. They can always come to the clerk's office and obtain copies.
Are there anything, Melvin Mouse?
Chief, just a couple of them. Thank you. I want to follow up on the Chief's earlier question, essentially suggesting that the proposal be shortened. I see that the existing rule concerning the certificate for form and length is what I would call a shortened version. In other words, it just states that I certify that the brief conforms to the rules contained in 809.19.8. B and C,
it doesn't reproduce the text of those rules.
That's right. And I like the way that that's done, and I actually hesitate a bit about the repetition is one word, redundancy is another, you know. Let me ask, do you have any objection to this, if I may, shorter version or version consistent with the current certification as to form and length?
With the caveat that I alluded to in the earlier questioning, and that part of the judge's thought is the more that a person is faced with the text, the more likely it is to sink in, I have to answer, I think the answer would be no, the court would not have an objection to the shorter version, because at least it does direct their attention to, you can't make the horse drink the water. I can't speak for the court.
Sure.
Totally, since I'm not honorable, but...
Oh, you're indeed not honorable. I also want to follow up on Justice Prosser's comment. He alluded to sanction, the word sanction. Is there currently provision for sanction for violation of the rule? Let me add to that question, would it be advantageous for the court to add a comment to the existing rule sub 2 or proposed rule 2A to indicate violation may result in sanction. I'm not suggesting it. I'm just placing it up for discussion.
Well, whether or not it's specifically mentioned is for your court. I believe that this would fall into the general sanction of 83, where if there's noncompliance, the court may sanction. I can assure you that the initial sanction, so to speak, would be simply be to not file the document, and certainly as we do now with briefs that don't comply with the rules, the filer is given every opportunity to file something in compliance.
There would be a what we call a safe harbor. In other words, they would surely know what you want. You would call that to their attention before they're...
I think in terms of a non-compliant brief, the clerk's office issues notice pointing out to them in what respects the brief is non-compliant and giving them an opportunity to file it. And with appendices, I can't speak for every situation in the court, but I would think that some monetary sanctions may be in order if it's really an egregious situation. But certainly the counsel would be forewarned. And I should, as long as we're on this general topic, the matter of pro se. Pro se compliance was discussed by the judges when this was on the table. And when it was first discussed, I did review the court's instructions, how the court has instructed the clerk's office to handle pro se briefs and appendices. And the court's current practice is that the court does accept for filing a brief from a self-represented person that may not have an appendix, and the judges in their discussion saw no reason to depart from that. In other words, if a brief from a self-represented person comes in and it may have an appendix but perhaps not the certification, that the clerk's office will accept it. The court does tend to extend lenience towards self-represented folks.
Well, sometimes there are groups. I'm just going to mention the Posse Comitatus, for example, that has filed many of these, and they have their own system of how to handle things.
I think if a pro se person has shown themselves to be a frequent litigator, they might be held to more knowledge of the rules.
If I may, a final question, at least for me, deals with the federal rule that has a specific provision as to what is excluded. I look at an appendix that comes in a case, a particular appendix, and sometimes it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Sometimes there's too much, sometimes there's not enough, and sometimes it's just right. One of the things I've been noting recently, at least in this court, is growing volume, and sometimes they have their brief in support of their motion for summary judgment in the circuit court. That really doesn't seem all that helpful or relevant and almost filler material. The federal rule, as I understand it, excludes materials that should not be, and it states, memoranda of law in the district court should not be included in the appendix unless they have independent relevance. Any merit to considering exclusion?
I'm certain that the federal rule, that there's merit to it in the sense that the federal rule found it useful. I think at this point in practice, in the culture of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, perhaps they wouldn't be in favor of going that far, since the purpose of this rule is to get things in the appendix. I don't think that there is a current problem, at least in front of the Court of Appeals, of too much material in the appendix. It might be that by the time a case is before your court that parties are including more material. Just to take that example, I did notice that the Seventh Circuit does, and other rules do tend to indicate what's excluded, and yet there was, I think it was Iowa, which is an incredibly cumbersome rule to read, indicated, well, no trial court briefs unless you're, unless necessary to rebut a claim of judicial estoppel, et cetera, et cetera. So, like every rule, creating a rule carries with it the list of exceptions, and in light of the inquiry on the bench bar survey about whether or not the rules of appellate procedure are too cumbersome and complicated, I'd be a little wary of going down that road.
Ms. Carlson?
Yes?
I note that the petition was presented from, by the Chief Judge on behalf of the court. Are each of the districts in support of this petition?
I believe so. It was discussed at a meeting of the judges where I don't recall the precise attendance, but it was fairly well attended. I'm certain there was someone from every district, and I'm not aware of any. Well, I take it back. It was not a unanimous vote. I can tell you that. So I'm not certain precise. I don't recall precisely why, but it was. But it was a clear majority.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes. Could I ask one other sort of procedural question? Am I inferring correctly that when a brief is filed in the Court of Appeals with an appendix, it is an employee of the clerk's office that reviews that brief to determine whether it should be filed?
I believe every brief is initially reviewed by the front desk people in the clerk's office there is a checklist that the clerk's office has developed, things that the court finds most important, primarily size, length, nothing. I know content is not one of the things they speak to. If there is a question as to whether or not a brief should be accepted for filing, the brief is submitted to the appropriate staff for the district. And that staff attorney will look at the brief and consult with the judge and give the clerk's office direction as to whether or not it should be accepted.
But I mean, is there someone in the clerk's office going through the brief to determine whether, say, confidentiality has been preserved?
I believe so.
Well, we can ask Ms. Clark to talk.
The clerk is nodding affirmatively.
Thank you.
Well, when the brief comes in, I assume there's some sort of date stamp.
I think that's true also.
Is that a filing? I mean, are briefs and appendices unfiled if they're not?
Ms. Clark can tell you that, and a procedure is also used for the briefs in this court that relates to form matters. The filing of a brief in a time period is not like filing other documents that are jurisdictional. So there's a leeway time, and Ms. Clark can tell you about sending out notices to lawyers also if the briefs are late so that they are put in. But it is not a jurisdictional issue, but she can do that.
I do believe there's the receive stamp and the file stamp, and if they're received on a certain date, and then if they pass the initial examination, then they're filed, accepted for filing.
And occasionally you will see our briefs have been unstapled and restapled because there's been a problem and it's been taken care of in the clerk's office. Any other questions for Ms. Carlson? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your
comments. Ms. Clark, do you, this is, you're subpoenaed. since there are questions, and I know it relates also to the to our court because I think similar procedures are in effect, why don't you just very briefly explain what happens in the clerk's office?
Okay. When a brief reaches the clerk's office, whether it's a Court of Appeals brief or a Supreme Court brief, my staff reviews that brief for what I call technical elements of a brief. We're looking at the case caption. Does that comply with the notices that we've sent to the parties? Is the appeal number correct? Does the front cover of the brief have all of the information that is required by the rules? Is there a front and back cover? Does the brief comply with the form and length requirements? And if we find any deficiencies in any of those things, we contact the filer and make them aware of the deficiency and ask that they correct it. Since briefs are can be filed now by mail if there's the appropriate mailing or affidavit or certificate, if a brief reaches my office and there are no problems, it's signed, it looks technically correct, that brief is stamped received, but it is entered in the computer as filed as of the date it was put in the mail, according to their affidavit. If a brief is filed that has an affidavit, but there's some other technical deficiency, we stamp that brief received. We issue what is called a brief correction notice, where we identify for all of the parties what the problem is. Once the brief has been corrected and is filed, then we issue an acknowledgement notice so everyone is aware of the date that the brief was filed. So, does that address all of your questions?
And many a time when you were here, I would see an attorney come in and unstaple all the briefs.
Correct.
Make corrections and restaple them and file them.
If an attorney is fairly close to Madison, a lot of times they'll send staff to correct the brief. If they're missing the certification, we'll have all of the briefs available for them. They'll send someone in, unstaple the brief, put in the affidavit, and correct the brief, and we file it in. If a caption is incorrect, they might just come in and replace the brief covers. If they've forgotten their signature page, they'll come in and place that in. Sometimes if an attorney is not convenient to Madison, we have to mail the briefs back to them for correction. But we do note on our docket that we did receive it and it's been returned for correction.
Thank
you. Seems fairly labor-intensive.
Yes, it is. We're a very busy office.
You do a very good job, and thank you.
Do you keep any statistics on sanctions, whether they're monetary sanctions of some kind, or are you just sending back, or any statistics on this?
Well, if we send a brief back, that's not really a sanction. A sanction would come from the court-by-court order. We don't really keep track of that unless it really depends on the sanction. If the court would issue an order a monetary sanction, then we would keep track of that because we expect the funds to come in.
And you, through CCAP or otherwise, make such a list, because Julie Rich's memo to us does give us some Court of Appeals sanctions that have been imposed, but they're in printed Court of Appeals decisions.
We don't really have a way of keeping track of that unless it impacts something that we have to watch for a future filing. If an attorney cannot practice before the Court of Appeals until he pays a certain fee, then we keep track of that simply for recognizing a paper when that attorney files something that we need to hold it up and check with the court before we file it in. So we don't really have a special code for tracking sanctions.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Clark. Are there any other appearances for or against 04-11? If not, the hearing on 04-11 is closed. We move to 05-05 in the matter of the amendment of WSSTAT 80705 stipulations and creation of WSSTAT 80125 relating to memorializing settlements reached by way of alternative dispute resolution. The presenter is Donald Leo Bach of Madison. Or maybe you prefer to be called Mr. Forrest.
Good morning. First of all, I can tell you that the Court of Appeals office is diligent. In my younger days, I filed a brief with tabs on it. I got called by the office, and they said, you have two choices. Either we can cut off the tabs, or you can submit a new brief.
What did you do?
I put little tabs. Oh, what choice did I make? I said cut off the tabs. And I've never done that again.
You imposed the expense on the state.
I did, and I apologize. Second, my day was made today when I heard the benchmark survey used in an argument to this court and the presentation of this court, especially as to a question that I drafted. Third, to make a comment, Justice Prosser, on an appeal, an attorney has the not only the time, but the opportunity to get all the files he or she needs. And I think the chief is right. If an attorney shows up without all the files and records, that's a matter of quality of practice. The rules do provide ample opportunity to get everything you need to come up here or the Court of Appeals for to make your case. May it please the court, the proposed rules before you attain narrow but important goals. Number one, to make agreements made on the record in a deposition binding just as those agreements are made binding in open court. Number two, and to require any settlement reached in mediation be put in writing and signed before the parties end their mediation session or sessions. The proposed rules promote the policy this court has endorsed on numerous occasions and as expressed in the very beginning in Chapter 801 of the statutes, and specifically in 801.01 parent 2, which provides that the rules are to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action and proceeding, which Judge Shabazz reminds us every time we come into court. The proposed rules should, 1, cut down on disputes, 2, put everybody on notice that these are the rules of the ball game, and 3, help prevent manipulation and backsliding. The first proposed rule simply requests that agreements, stipulations, and consents made on the record during a deposition be made binding. At depositions, commonly and routinely, and I can tell you this from 30 years of taking depositions, agreements and stipulations are made on the record often. They should be enforceable, and they should be able to be relied upon. Some of the very common agreements and stipulations made at depositions are as follows. I won't call John Jones as a witness. I won't make a claim for breach of contract. I'm not claiming punitive damages. Often there's an agreement as to the amount in dispute. When attorney's fees are at issue, sometimes there's an agreement as to attorney's fees. Agreements not to use specific exhibits or set of exhibits. A very important one, an agreement to allow the other side to see an attorney-client document with the agreement that it will not waive attorney-client privilege to move the deposition along. Agreements as to the length and scope of follow-up deposition. I will take, if I have to, another deposition. I promise you I'll limit it to an hour, hour and a half. We'll only go into the area of damages. Agreements as to the clients and their attorneys allowing contact with your client. Happens all the time in litigation, especially if the parties have an ongoing relationship. Stipulations as to facts. For example, counsel, we agree that this is the only letter that was sent in response, right? There were no other letters sent in response, right? That's right, counsel. It may take 10 or 15 questions right off the table. Agreements to partially settle claims. However, the state of the law is that an attorney can represent just about anything he or she wants at a deposition and be able to walk away from that representation or agreement essentially at will. This is reflected in the case law in the Bertram case. A stipulation was made on the record at a deposition as to attorney's fees. There was a full agreement, but the party backed out and the court was forced to not enforce the agreement made at the deposition because of the wording and limited coverage of Wisconsin 507. Now let's turn to mediation, and the same principles apply. Mediation and some of the other alternative dispute resolution processes, but primarily mediation, has been found to be a very good method of resolving disputes short of a full court trial. However, mediation, as I well know and other attorneys know, can be time-consuming, and it can be relatively expensive. It also involves the spending of emotional resources, And also in mediation, if you have a good mediation, the strengths and weaknesses of your case are revealed to the other side and vice versa. So when you reach a settlement after all of that hard work and dollar and emotional and tactical cost, that settlement should stick, it should be enforceable, and it should provide finality and end the controversy. But again, Wisconsin Stat 80507 and case law says, unless that settlement is in writing and is signed, even if the mediator records that settlement word for word and sends out the settlement to all the parties and their attorneys, that settlement is not enforceable and binding.
No, and the arbitration or the mediation provision is.
Arbitration is absolutely binding, and I'm talking only about settlements. With arbitration, you get a decision from an arbitrator.
So isn't that ultimately encompassed in the settlement agreement, ultimately encompassed in whatever the mediator or arbitrator does?
If it's a mediator, no. It is not binding until the parties sign. If it's arbitration, you get a decision.
Right.
You get a decision.
In mediation, what you want, if I understand you, is should the parties agree somewhere in mediation as to A or B, whatever, you want that binding even if mediation is not conclusively finished.
No. All I want is the final settlement binding. That's all I want. In the Alaska case, they came, after apparently a long mediation, I mean, that's what it looks like, they came to an agreement that one of the parties would pay $135,000 and not make any further claims. It was in a will dispute case. Everybody agreed. Mediator agreed. A couple of weeks later, the party backed out of it.
What about minor matters? They may not be so minor. Within the mediation where the guy says, oh, I agree to that, I just don't agree to that, I stipulate to this, but then they don't ultimately agree.
I wouldn't make it binding. I think you should be able to take any position you want in mediation until you're done. That goes back and forth all the time. And in fact, you see in mediation, it's a very open process where somebody will say, yeah, I'll agree to do that. But then later on in the afternoon, because of another factor, they'll say, well, now I don't want to agree to that. I don't want to touch any of that. All I want to do is when they're done and when they stand up and shake hands and say, we have settled this case, all I want the mediator to do is be required to put that in writing and have the people sign it. That's all I want. Nothing more. That's why these rule changes are narrow, narrowly drafted. The proposal before you in regard to mediation should provide some of the following benefits. It puts everyone on notice that the settlement reached in mediation isn't final until it's reduced to paper and signed. Number two, and importantly, it tells professional mediators that having everyone sign is a minimum requirement of their job. That's a minimum requirement. Mediators should not leave the table if there's a settlement until he or she gets that thing signed. It provides the parties another opportunity to clarify, confirm, and potentially change their agreement through this final step of putting it on paper. It happens all the time.
Mr. Bach, just a question. I was thinking, because I can see the real value of this in mediation. Put it in writing, have it signed, and it's final. It seems to be run counter to your other proposal that in a deposition you have this stipulation which isn't put in writing, and then they can back out. Now, the case law is, as you pointed out, it should be put in writing, subscribed to by the party or by their attorney. Yet in mediation, you see the difference? In other words,
I do, but it's the same principle, and the principle is people should live up to their word. But we have two completely different types of procedures here. A deposition is an adversary proceeding. What's said under deposition can be used in court and will be used in court. If people are put on notice on a deposition, this is adversary. Be on guard. In a mediation, the rules are just the opposite, and well should be. You can say anything you want in a mediation. It is not allowable in evidence. So it does seem contradictory, but it really isn't. All I'm saying is when you get to mediation and you settle, don't allow the situation in Alaska to happen. After spending all of that time and all of that money and everybody, all that emotional trauma, everybody stands up and shakes hands and says, we're done. And then 3 weeks later, somebody says, well, I didn't sign it. I'm backing out of this.
Well, look, what about 5 says settlement. Any settlement reached as a result of use of an alternative dispute resolution method. 809-802-12, of which this is the last subsection, has binding arbitration, direct negotiation, early neutral evaluation, focus group, mediation, mini-trial, moderated settlement conference, non-binding arbitration, settlement alternative means, all of that plus summary jury trial. Does 5 only deal with mediation?
No. It deals with any settlement reached as any one of those processes. Now, it could be made clearer, now that I see your point, you could say, except for a decision reached in binding arbitration. And I think that's semantics. I don't consider a decision reached in binding arbitration a settlement, though the statute says settlement alternative.
It says alternative dispute resolution.
Right.
And that's the word you use. That's why I keep questioning you about this, because you might have a settlement within an arbitration just like you have a settlement within a trial.
Absolutely.
Or in a deposition. You might have that. And the way this reads, if you, during arbitration, stipulated to something, you are bound under 80705, if it's a made in writing or made during a proceeding under 80713, and I didn't check those.
The 80713 and 96708 are telephonic scheduling conferences for civil and criminal cases, respectively.
All right.
And by the way, those two things make my point. During those telephonic settlement, during those telephonic civil conferences with the judge, when you make an agreement, that's binding.
Well, it's usually transcribed.
It is usually transcribed.
And the
just like in a deposition.
And it's like open court.
It is like open court.
So that's just part of the open court proceedings. So I still have a problem with 5. I still don't quite see what its range is going to be.
Well, let me address this. You are absolutely right, Chief. During an arbitration, it is not unusual for the parties to say at a break, let's end this. Let's just end this. Let's settle. It happens in court all the time.
Let's eliminate one issue, but keep on with the other. We agree on liability. Let's just do damages.
Right. But typically, that is made to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator rules at that point. My ruling is we will not go into damages. I didn't mean to conflate the two and cause confusion. I'm trying to not cause confusion.
I know. So I want to know which of these, you're saying it covers, your rule covers all of them. Okay.
I didn't want to exclude a settlement reached in arbitration. I didn't want to say, well, in arbitration, you can settle. Bob Jones and I can settle, but because that's an exclusion, we don't have to write that down.
Okay. So if you settle within an arbitration, within a mediation, within a focus group, if you reduce it to writing, date it, and sign, you're bound. But if you don't reduce it to writing, date it, and sign it, you're not bound. That's how this now reads.
Yes, except if there are attorneys out there with honor. I mean, there are some people who are bound.
We're dealing not with attorneys.
We're dealing with the statute, and you're correct.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. Counsel, do you have any objection if this court, since these are rules of pleading and practice, solicit comments from the state bar litigation section or any mediation section or other entities regarding these?
I have absolutely no problem with that, would welcome it. I would tell you that I did talk to the state bar. They sent it out internally and got no comment. I checked
it out. August 29th, according to a memorandum I must have picked up from the Board of Governors book. They sent it out and asked the alternative dispute resolution. They have a wrong number, but I'm sure they could figure that one out. And they asked that it make its comments September 30th to October 1. I have a basic problem with this, with Justice Bradley's suggestion. This was filed in February
of 2005,
right? Now it's October, March, April, May, June, July, August, September. It's 8 months. We haven't gotten anything in the file. So everybody was on notice. The bar is on notice because I'm assuming they read their own Wisconsin lawyer. Well, you're not the bar. So my question is, and we have done that. In fact, we're going to deal on 409 where we've asked for comments. So if we're going to proceed in that manner, maybe we have to do that as soon as something is filed, send out letters and pleading practice to the bar and others that the court foresees might have an interest. Do you know what I'm trying to say? Now we put out the published notice. This really affects the bar. It may affect consumers, but you're not going to get litigants in arms about this, I don't think. We're really talking about lawyers making a deal, one assumes, with the party's approval. That isn't an issue in this case. So have you heard any comments on this?
Only from the state bar that they had none. I've talked to, you know, other litigators. I think one of the reasons you haven't heard any comments is it's pretty hard for a lawyer to stand up here and say, I don't want a rule that doesn't allow me to back out of my agreements at will. I mean, I want to be able to represent anything, manipulate, do what I want. That's why I don't think you've heard any comments.
Counselor, I have a question for you that is of some concern to me. I wonder about the impact of your proposed change to 807.05 for those folks that have a deposition taken without counsel present. I can really see if a lawyer is doing a deposition of an unrepresented person and the person doesn't think quickly on his or her feet, you could really sign them up for a lot of stipulations right there that may not be in their best interest, and they may not at all understand the impact of those kinds of stipulations. How do you respond to my concern about those folks?
Well, first of all, there's always that problem when there are people that are unrepresented decide not to have lawyers. I mean, the deposition itself, you're probably going to get, you know, a lot of admissions out. I'm not talking about admissions. I'm talking about agreements.
You can do the same thing. A lawyer is going to ask a guy a question, and just like the example you gave us, you know, do you have any pain in your back? No, I don't have any back pain. Well, then we're going to agree there's not going to be any back pain claim in this lawsuit, correct? And the guy says, yeah. Well, you know, I can see that the playing field would not be level. And
well,
I guess that concerns me a little bit.
Well, I don't think trial court judges would treat that the same as when a lawyer makes a representation to stick up to. I think trial courts, in my 30 years of experience, have always bent over backwards to make sure that people represented pro se get a fair shake.
They're also obligated to follow the statute.
Right, correct. Right. And in your case, I think once you ask the question, do you have any back pain? No. You don't need to go to the person and say, well, then you're not making any claim as to back pain. It's over. And the thing I worry about is that we're going to allow this situation to occur because there may be an instance where some lawyer tries to gain advantage over a pro se client. But that happens all the time anyway. So I understand your concern, but I'd hate to see these rules stop for that reason.
Don't we already have in the rules of civil procedures sufficient safeguard vis-a-vis the amendment on depositions that you're offering? For instance, if it were an important thing, and the question is asked regarding calling, you know, Mr. Jones, and the response of counsel is, I don't intend to call Mr. Jones. I mean, can't, if that's a matter of consequence, can't it be followed up with a written stipulation? Or if there's a particular fact that you thought was going to be relevant, and they say, no, we're not going to be claiming that, can't that be followed up with a demand to admit?
Sure, but that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to make this speedy and inexpensive. If you go to a deposition and you say, are you making any claim for punitive damages? I am not. So we're agreed there's no claim for punitive damages. That just saved you probably 30 to 50 questions on the deposition. It saved you a request to admit. It saved you going through documents. It's just a way of things making it faster.
I didn't ask questions because I thought, well, maybe we'll, you know, get input, because my sense is there would be a number of if people are focusing it, concerns. You say, the question of, do you intend to call John Jones? That was me. And the answer, the attorney at the deposition at that time is, no, I don't. Okay, well, all of a sudden, then 3 weeks later, you find out that John Jones does indeed have some information that's relevant. Or your hypothetical of, is this the last paper that was that you sent? And the answer is yes. And then you find out later, you know, it seems like if it is a matter of consequence that there are already tools within the pleading and practice to nail that down, if you will. And I'm concerned about the statute now allows you to make it binding, but there are procedural, in my mind, procedural safeguards. It can be binding if done in open court. And a judge kind of, you know, is the referee. I have a, and can monitor these stipulations. Or it can be done in writing, where there's an opportunity for greater reflection than what may be the spur-of-the-moment response. And so it could be that making in cement the in context of the give and take of the deposition might create more problems. I'm not sure, but I think it might create more problems than trying to undo it subsequently.
I disagree. There's a simple legal concept that a deposition, if you don't want to agree, you just say no. Are you going to make claim for back pain? I don't know yet. I'm not making that decision. You ask whatever questions you want to ask. That's the way it works at depositions. Nobody's forcing any attorney to make any agreement, consent, stipulation, or anything at a deposition. The answer is no. No, I'm not making that agreement.
Mr. Bach, I don't know if this is the intent of the proposed rule, but it certainly seems to be an effect of the proposed rule that it would preclude parties from changing their mind later. I think, as you indicated earlier, you want people to stand by their word. But I guess I have similar concerns that have been expressed here that, particularly when you're dealing with pro se, but not just necessarily pro se, because you might have an attorney who's going in is just going to handle that position, doesn't understand all the ins and outs of the case, know it perhaps as well as the opposing counsel. And they get all of a sudden locked into something that might hurt the case down the road. Isn't the way the rule is currently phrased designed in a way that gives parties that last-minute reflection to kind of, well, maybe we really don't want to do that? And Justice Bradley's question, don't the rules currently allow for you to lock in if that's really what you want to do?
Yeah, but the current rules also allow you to manipulate. You could say anything you want at a deposition. And look, anytime you make an agreement, whether it's an open court, in writing, or at a deposition, you always have the right to go to the... First of all, if you don't agree anymore, let's say you say, I'm not going to call John Jones as a witness. But then you decide 3 weeks later, boy, John has got some great information, I'm going to call him. The first thing you do is you call opposing counsel and say, look, I told you I wasn't going to call John Jones. I really need to call him. Would you agree that I can call John Jones? And the other side, if they got enough time, will say, yeah, probably you can. If the other side says no, you go to your trial court judge. Anytime you make an agreement, even in open court, if you need to back out of that agreement, you go to your trial court judge and say, I made a mistake. The purpose, but at least the other side gets notice. At least it's fair play. What I'm trying to avoid, and a lot of trial lawyers are trying to avoid, is, are you going to make a claim for back pain? No, I'm not. You don't ask the 20 questions. You don't get the back pain expert. And all of a sudden at the pretrial conference, you're looking at a back pain expert on the other side, and you said, well, you said you weren't going to make a claim for back pain. Wasn't in writing, was it, counsel? No, it wasn't. Trial courts, you know, can be upset, but is essentially powerless.
Well, it seems to me you can have discovery at that time, maybe absolutely late in the game, but you have the right to go in and ask your 20 questions. Get your own witness. I mean, clearly the trial judge is, especially where there's the deposition recorded by a stenographer on videotape, it's going to show you're right, you were misled. It's only fair that you get it. So the question really is whether or not making this binding when
these agreements are made during litigation when parties don't have all of the information, whether that really will create more problems than less. I mean, that's the tenor of the questions. And I just want to get back to sub 5 if I can. It says any settlement reached as a result. Yet 80705 talks about agreements, stipulations, or consent. Is that what you mean by settlement?
No. They're two different things.
Yeah, what do you mean by settlement?
Settlement is a final resolution of the case.
Okay, is it defined anywhere? Because I don't see it defined in 80212.
It's not.
So instead of settlement, if this is adopted, you should say any final resolution of the dispute, of the case, reached as a result. And then don't you mean shall be binding if reduced to writing, dated, and signed? Isn't that what you're really trying to do?
No.
What are you trying to do?
First of all, let me back off a little. Let me take away my agreement that I just made. I'm a little worried about mediation where you do get a partial mediated result. For example, you may get a mediated result that says we'll pay you the consequential damages of $500,000, but we all agree we're going to go to court on punitive damages. So I'm a little worried about final resolution. Second, the purpose of 5 is simply to require it be put in writing. Not that it be binding. I mean, if it's in writing, I'm assuming it's going to be binding.
Well, you shouldn't assume that. That's the whole point of this. The whole point of it is it's binding if it's in writing. It's not binding if it's not in writing.
I think you can make that conclusion, yes. It should say unbinding, yes. That's the point to get around the Alaska case. You're right.
Right. So you have to do that. So it doesn't mean shall be reduced. It doesn't. The judge doesn't have to order someone to reduce it to writing. The point is, if it is reduced, it's binding. If it's not reduced, you got a problem.
I agree.
Okay. So,
all right. What was the final resolution of the question of whether settlement should be defined in some way?
I think if it adds clarity to the rule, we should define it.
You see, the whole 80212 talks about settlement in terms of settlement alternative, not agreement, stipulation, or consent. And I don't know why you're not willing to put in any agreement, stipulation, or consent between the parties reached as a result of the use of alternative resolution shall not be binding unless reduced to writing.
Because mediation is different than depositions. I don't want people to have to go into mediation and say, all right, we made an agreement this morning that the sky was blue. We got to put that in writing. That's not how mediations work. There's all kinds of agreements that are made in mediation that are backed away from because of other things. I don't want to complicate mediation. The only thing I want to do in mediation is that when you're done, put it in writing. That's all I want. Nothing else. Simple rule.
Well, doesn't appear so simple. Because you're not willing to substitute alternative dispute resolution for mediation. And then you're not willing to say final dispute resolution, and I suppose you could say in part that would take care of if you have a partial agreement.
Well, I use alternative dispute resolution.
I know, which covers 5 or 6 different techniques.
Right, which was my intent.
I think Ms. Justice Butler has a question.
No,
pardon me? Oh,
that's
I'm sorry.
I don't.
Justice Prosser.
Mr. Bach. Do you have a written statement there? Or
I just have my...
He has a petition and then you have a rationale. That's
right.
My written statement. And if I heard you correctly, your written statement, your oral statement to the court today encompassed much of your written statement. Is that correct?
Okay. What I'm getting at is on the first part of your proposal, relating to agreements, stipulations, and consent, you threw out so many interesting examples that my poor mind was not able to absorb them all. And I suppose we can get them off the tape, but I'd sort of like to reflect on that a little bit by having those examples.
I'll give you my piece of paper that I read from, Justice, and you can have it. All of them are listed.
Okay. Well, if we could get that page anyway, just...
It's the one that you submitted with the petition?
No. This is my oral statement with the examples. I won't call John Jones, I won't make a claim, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So you have that. Defendant's counsel, when did you first start having back pain? Objection, we're not making any claim for back pain. And then you go on. That's in your rationale. The other one you gave was the Doe Company construct the boiler, and they stipulate that it's nothing to do with a permit.
Nothing to do with this case.
Yeah. Right.
But when you were speaking, you ran
into
quite a number of different
right.
examples. I would love to have those.
I'll give those to you.
I find your... it seems to me what you're trying to get at is when you go to deposition with someone and a party closes the door, then they shouldn't, at least without good cause, be able to open the door again.
Precisely put, Justice.
Because it frustrates the very purpose of the deposition.
Precisely put.
But it seems to me that there's... You might be able to achieve this by some explicit sanction as an alternative way to do that. I don't know. I sort of like your idea. Do you know whether there is any precedent in other jurisdictions for a rule like this?
I do not. And as far as sanctions, I think trial courts have been upset when this happens, but they're powerless. The trial court can't do much unless they tie it somehow to the scheduling order, and that's what happened in the case, in the Bertram case. The trial court, you know, said, there's nothing I can do. There's no rules that allow me to get involved in your deposition. Now, I will tell you, there is a new case, and I'm kind of somewhat reluctant to talk about it because it's on petition for review for you, and it's called Affordable Erectors. And I don't know whether I can talk about it or not, but the same problem arose. So that's probably going to come up in front of you where there was an agreement, people backed out of it. Now, the trial court got very ingenious.
I think we should not discuss that case. You raised it. That case is on the docket.
All right.
If it hasn't already been ruled on, and I don't think we should discuss that. With all due respect,
I understand, Chief, completely.
Okay.
And I have no dog that hunts in that case. So,
but I do have a question, if I can follow up Justice Prosser's question. Because I'm concerned about whether or not the purpose of depositions is the same. Isn't the purpose of depositions to obtain information to get a better handle or understanding of the case? The purpose of settlements or agreements is to kind of close out the case. And I understand why it's valuable to be able to do one in the other, but I also understand why it could complicate things. To lock somebody in at the precise moment when you're trying to get information, to lock them up, it definitely would favor the better prepared counsel or the counsel versus the pro se litigant. And so I'm wondering, do you really want to lock everybody in at that point in time just because somebody had done their homework better?
Well, first of all, again, all your opposing counsel has to say is no. It's easy. It takes less than 1 second. No, I'm not agreeing. And second, depositions to trial attorneys provide much more than a role of gathering information. That's why we've had a plethora and increase in summary judgment motions, which end cases early. It's because attorneys know how to take depositions. And remember, at a deposition, it's not just to find out information. It's to get the deponent, if you can, to agree to your case and to get the deponent to degrade his case. So depositions are very useful, very important in trial practice, and depositions tend, if they're done right, to end cases early or narrow issues. So any attorney that walks into a deposition representing a client that says, oh, heck, I'm just here, they're just going to get information out of my client, isn't doing their job. And again, all the attorney has to say is, no, ask whatever questions you want. I'm not agreeing to anything at this point. It's simple.
Any other questions? One of the follow-ups to Justice Prosser's area of inquiry, again, regarding sanctions. For instance, in a demand to admit, the written demand to admit, my recollection is if you don't admit and then you can prove it, you get the cost. Available sanction is the cost it takes you to prove that demand.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. So there are... in the statutes, in the discovery statutes, some options like that.
But I'll tell you, when I get a request to admit, the chances of me admitting that are somewhat limited and very carefully answered for that reason. And it's a very formal request. It takes time to prepare. It takes time to answer. We're trying to save some of that.
Well, that's the problem, it seems to me, in your proposal. You're trying to save it, and yet... what you're doing is binding parties when they may be making these stipulations or agreements in less formal, less fully thought out situations. And then the balance is, one, you save time, you save energy, you save effort, and it's fairness, and you want to promote that lawyers' words are their bonds. And you balance that against the fact that it is informal. It is may not be fully aware. It's not done in the cool, calm reflection sitting at your desk with the ability to do a little more research or talk to other people in the firm about what they think about it, et cetera. And that's the balance. And you have struck the balance in this petition in favor of the former, namely your bond, your word is your bond. And the question in the other documents and sanctions is to make it more formal, therefore you bind. So that's the balance. And if I've been unfair in setting that forth, I'm sure you'll tell me.
I will make one comment, Judge, and that's if you want a pressure-packed situation, that's an open court. When the judge leans across and says, are you two agreeing on this, yes or no, that's pressure-packed. And you know, if you say yes, you're bound. You're bound, bound, bound. And that happens. You don't have a chance to talk to your partners. You don't have a chance to look at something. It happened to me the other day in the court. The trial court said, are you and you agreeing that X is not part of this case? And the answer was, we looked at each other and said, yes. Well, the court said, fine. I just won't even go into that. We were bound. Now, that's pressure. That's pressure.
Oh, you could have said what you said.
I could have said no.
You could have said... I am not prepared to answer that now. I think we should proceed, and the next time we appear, we can answer that. Or I will advise the court in 24 hours. Right?
Could have said. We're on a temporary restraining order, though, so it's a little hard to come back in a month or 24 hours.
Not so final, either.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, Mr. Bach, thank you for
your time. Thank you for your time.
I want to say on behalf of the court, thank you for caring. It's rare that an individual lawyer comes up with a petition, and we appreciate the time and the effort and thought that went into your preparing and your taking the time and effort to bring this matter to the court's attention, regardless of what the court's particular ruling on it is. So let me say thank you on behalf of the court.
And on behalf of an individual lawyer, let me thank the court for taking the time on some of these important issues.
Thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to make an appearance on 0505? Relating to stipulations. Hearing none, we close the hearing on 0500.
05. Now, the court will take a few moments in recess, and then we'll be back to make decisions of what it wants to do on the two that we've heard and one that we heard earlier, 0409, about which we got additional information. So the open hearing is adjourned.